Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, Finn at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Offbeat Oregon History Daily Podcast. Thank you for loading me down and queuing me up today. It's Friday, so we have a new column, freshly added to the archives. You probably know this, but the newspapers get a two-month exclusive on each Offbeat Oregon History column. The end of that 2 months, they go into the archives, and I post them at OffbeatOregon.com and record a podcast from them. And for this story, those 2 months have just gone by. So here it is. I hope you enjoy it. Well, it had been a good 20 years since Bill Miner had been put into the can in San Quentin. When he got out, he discovered he was going to have to learn a brand new skill: robbing railroad trains. Eventually, he'd get pretty good at this, but his learning curve, well, it started in Portland and it ended in disaster. Here's the story of Bill's first train robbery, which, by the way, was first published on November 10th of 2013 under the headline "Outlaw Bill Miner's First Train Robbery Was a Fiasco." It had been a good 20 years, but Bill Miner was back and once again, as he liked to say, on the rob. Specifically, he was lurking with his partner behind a pile of baggage on an eastbound express train a dozen or so miles out of Portland, Oregon, waiting for his chance. It was September of 1903, and Bill was about to rob his very first railroad train. Or rather, try to. Bill Miner, aka the Gray Fox, was already a well-known outlaw by this time, a specialist in the frontier art of robbing stagecoaches. Part of the reason he was so well known is he wasn't particularly good at it. Rather, actually, he wasn't very good at not getting caught afterward. Bill had spent 34 of his 54 years in one prison or another. Most of that time had been done at San Quentin. His most recent stint there had been particularly lengthy, 20 years for stagecoach robbery. When the Gray Fox got out of the joint, he found that the march of progress had made his skills obsolete. In the early 1880s, when Bill was first sent to prison, his area of expertise had been one of the most valuable specialties in criminal society. Stagecoaches were common in the American West. They frequently carried strong boxes full of gold and valuables, and they followed predictable routes. Robberies were common, and so were the stories of the dapper, courteous, gentleman bandit who called himself Bill Miner. But after his release, Bill found a different world waiting for him outside. There were hardly any stagecoaches in use anymore, and the ones that were still around didn't carry any money. They weren't even worth robbing. The real action, Bill realized, was in robbing railroad trains. Train robbery was a different kind of thing. You couldn't just step out in front of one and level a Winchester and order it to stop. Train robbery required new skills, better planning, more subtlety. Bill would have to adapt or get out of the business. At first, the erstwhile Gray Fox chose to get out of the business. He moved to Washington, where he wasn't much known, and got a job working in an oyster bed. But a couple of years of the law-abiding life were about all he could take, and when the call of easy money finally came, it found him eager and ready to go. The call came from an old pal from San Quentin, counterfeiter J. Guy Harshman. Harshman had gotten out of the queue at about the same time as Bill, and he'd been working shifts at a sawmill in the lower Columbia River town of Goble. But he'd been thinking about taking on a train and wondered if Bill might like to team up. Bill didn't need to be asked twice. He quit his job at the oyster beds, moved to Goble, took a job in the mill with Guy. He recruited a third man, a baby-faced young fella named Charles Kid Hohen, and they had a team. And they started making plans. Their first attempt was an embarrassment. The train they planned to rob just lumbered blissfully by, and they realized they'd set the stop signal for the wrong set of tracks. And it was just as well, as they later realized, because their getaway plan, which was to hightail it to Portland and get lost in the crowd, probably wouldn't have worked. So they'd regrouped and done some more careful planning. And that planning had led to the heist Miner was getting ready for now, hiding behind that luggage with Harshman, his partner, waiting for the right moment. When that moment came, he and Harshman stood up, drew their revolvers, and climbed through the gangway into the engine, where they found the engineer and fireman. Quote, They ordered us to run the train to 21 milepost and stop at the light, which would be found there, Engineer Ollie Barrett later recalled. The bandits told us that if we kept still and obeyed orders, we would not be harmed, and we did so. At 21 milepost, another masked man came out of the brush on the right side of the railroad and joined us as the train stopped. That other masked man was Kid Hoehn, who had brought the getaway vehicle, a rowboat tied up in the nearby Columbia River. The gang was all together now, and now it was time to go get the money. Accordingly, the three of them ordered the engineer and fireman to come back with them to the express car, where the valuables were kept. Meanwhile, inside the express car, clerks Fred Corner and Solomon Glick were getting very nervous. When the train had stopped unexpectedly, Corner had suspected something was wrong, so he'd put the light out in the express car and got his sawed-off shotgun ready, and waited to see if this unscheduled stop meant what he thought it meant. He got his answer a few minutes later in the voice of Engineer Barrett. Quote,
"It's Barrett. Open the door. Don't shoot."
Corner and Glick had no intention of opening that door. But they knew what would be happening next, so they retreated as far away from the door as they could get and plugged their ears. Sure enough, Miner and Harshman were ready with the dynamite. They lit the fuse, they propped the explosives against the door, and they hustled back to the engine. Two great explosions lit up the night. When the smoke of the blast cleared away, there was a big hole in the express car door, but still no movement inside. But even as the bandits were hustling back to the badly damaged car, Corner was silently opening the baggage door at the rear of the car, shotgun at the ready. From the shadows, he stealthily drew a bead on the lead robber and pulled the trigger. The blast of buckshot took Harshman to the ground instantly, looking very dead. A stray pellet hit Barrett in the shoulder. Kid Hoehn dropped everything and ran for his life, ran for the boat. Bill Miner wasn't far behind. Corner hustled out of the car and, seeing their shadowy forms fleeing down the hillside, sent the other barrel's worth of buckshot whistling past their ears, although they were by then too far away for the sawed-off shotgun to be effective. When they reached the river, the two of them leaped into the boat and rowed furiously downstream to Kalama on the Washington side. Then, agreeing that they'd be less likely to be made if they split up, they went their separate ways. Harshman was taken to the hospital, where he was not expected to live. But to general surprise, he rallied, and when he regained consciousness, he ratted his former partners out. Hoehn was found in Everett, Washington, and arrested. He drew a 10-year stretch for his part in the caper, and Harshman, when he recovered, got 12. As for Miner, he ran across the border into British Columbia, where he perpetrated Canada's first ever train robbery. This one was rather more successful and netted him $300,000 worth of loot. Caught again, he was sentenced to prison in BC, but escaped after a year or so under suspicious circumstances. The rumor persists to this day that the Canadian government let him escape to the US in exchange for a promise to tell them where the $300,000 was stashed. In any case, he was shortly back in the States, although he never came back to Oregon. He finished out his days robbing trains in the Georgia area, once again in and out of jails and prisons. He died on September 1st, 1913, at the age of 67. Well, that's our show for today. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. In addition to this podcast, it includes a weekly newspaper column, a daily RSS feed to catch on your smartphone newsreader, a series of live history shows, a Facebook page, and a couple of other minor components, YouTube channel, Tumblr, blog, stuff like that, all accessible through our anchor page at offbeatoregon.com. Visual goodies and other resources that go with today's show can be found at offbeatoregon.com, where you'll also find full citations to the sources for this story, as well as more than 250 other Offbeat Oregon History columns written over the past 5 years. Like this podcast, those articles are covered under a Creative Commons license. For details, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, and was written by Carmen Ficarra. I do Offbeat Oregon History for fun and to learn stuff, so I don't sell advertising or ask for donations, but if you enjoy Offbeat Oregon History and would like to support it, you can always buy a copy of my book. If you enjoy this podcast, I can almost guarantee that you will like the book. It's called Wicked Portland. It's published by the History Press in 2012, and they're available at community bookstores. Or if you like, you can order a signed copy through the store link at offbeatoregon.com or catch me at one of the shows. It sells for $20. Finally, if you're ever in the neighborhood near Oregon State University, do drop me a line. Maybe we can grab a cup of coffee in the library coffee shop and talk about history. I'm at finn@offbeatorgan.com. Our next show will be coming your way around 6 a.m. Monday morning. And until then, go out and fill up the rest of today and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.